It's time for this week's edition of Sports Lit 101. And Bruce, we continue our discussion that began last week about the new book, Beyond the Black Power Salute, Athlete Activism in an era of Change. And we've got a special guest joining us this week.
Sure do. We have my friend Joel Schrantz. I think you're in Philadelphia at the moment, correct? Who was at North Carolina as a graduate student, and who helped put together a documentary that we talked about before called What Binds Us to This Place, which was about the strike in 1969 at North Carolina. When this book came out and I read the third chapter, I immediately thought of contacting Joel, because the third chapter of the book is called Athletes Flex Their Muscles. And we know how athletes have flexed their muscles to get changes in the NCAA. We know how African-American students on campuses have pushed to get better rights, to get better representation. We've talked about how workers organized for certain reasons. But here's the strike where all three of those things came together. So, Joel, if you could sort of take us through the early part of that, I'd really appreciate it.
Absolutely. And it's great to be here. Thanks, everyone, for having me on. So, of course, the 1960s, especially in the South, was a very, very turbulent time politically and in terms of Black folks who were struggling for their freedom and equality and dignity in many different facets of life, including at the university campus. And Charlie Scott, who I think is one of the prominent characters in that chapter, Bruce, was the first Black scholarship athlete in UNC's history. And he and then the second Black scholarship athlete, Bill Chamberlain, were both from Harlem and were coming out in the context of the Black Power movement in Harlem, and came down to North Carolina, where they were faced with a new world and a new reality of race relations. At the same time that they were entering the university, the cafeteria workers were organizing and understood that they were really being taken advantage of, both economically, but also in terms of their own dignity and their the way in which their supervisors, who were white, would interact with them. And they decided to call a strike. And the third component, as you mentioned, is something called the Black Student Movement, which was inaugurated a couple of years earlier and was also very much fighting for their own dignity and expressing solidarity with the people around them. So as soon as the strike began in early 1969, the Black student movement was there to support it. And slowly, the two basketball players became involved, especially Bill Chamberlain.
One of the things that struck me, excuse me, is quite interesting is that I had a chance to meet Dean Smith when I was probably about 14, 15 years old, the legendary UNC coach. And Charlie Scott went to him and asked him if he could sort of belong to the Black student movement. And Dean Smith said yes, and was really probably the first major collegiate coach in any sport to actively say to your players, yeah, I don't want you to get arrested, I don't want you throwing firebombs, but you have a right to be who you are. Did that you think that had anything to do with helping that strike along?
I absolutely do. Yeah, I definitely think Dean Smith was a very important person in all of that. Not the most, for sure, but definitely played a role. But one story about him that I like even more than that one is that Bill Chamberlain, the second Black scholarship athlete, actually brought Dean Smith the workers' petition that the BSM, the Black Student Movement, had put together. And this story is amazing. So Dean Smith was in his office talking to the university chancellor when Bill Chamberlain walked up. And Dean Smith actually told the chancellor if he could wait in the hall while he talked to his player. And that just sort of shows you the kind, you know, no one gets in between Coach Smith and his player. But Bill Chamberlain showed him the petition, and Dean Smith talked to him for a while. And then when the chancellor came back in, he said to the chancellor, I'm going to sign this, and I'm going to ask other people in the academic department to do the same. So Dean Smith was definitely involved in that, both in Charlie Scott and Bill Chamberlain's sort of political solidarity, but then, of course, influencing the greater community.
One of the things I found most interesting about Charlie Scott was that he was, Terry Edwards wanted him to boycott the Olympics, to not go to Mexico City. And Charlie Scott said, wait a minute, I worked too hard to start integration. I don't want to become a separatist now, or something to that effect. I don't remember exactly what he said. And it seems to me that that was probably, I mean, what Carlos and Smith did at the 68 Olympics resonated, and it had a lot to do with what happened afterwards. But it seemed to me that that was probably, being in the South, a huge step forward in a way that's probably underappreciated today.
Yeah, I think that's really true. I think it's a really complicated political moment there when Harry Edwards was trying to do something that I think has its own legitimacy, absolutely, with a boycott. But then, of course, people saying, no, I have these reasons of my own to go forward. And yeah, maybe to show that it's not going to be separatist, but the desegregation and ultimately integration that will happen through this also has its own value. And I actually don't know that aspect of Charlie Scott's life as much as his involvement at UNC, but I definitely think it's an enormous, it has ramifications that rippled out through the South.
I often wonder if UNC was the best place in the South for this to happen. I mean, Chapel Hill was always a more progressive place than, well, we won't name some of the other cities and land-grant universities in the South. But it was still the South, and it was still just a few years out of the Jim Crow South. But do you think that there was something about maybe the faculty, the administration, the student body at North Carolina that made it more likely for this movement to succeed there than it would have, say, at NC State or South Carolina or Arkansas?
Yeah, I think so. I don't want to give Chapel Hill too much credit because I think it drags its heels to this day. While also great things happen there and courageous things happen there. But yeah, I do think so. I think it being a progressive place and sort of the city on the hill and all the different ways it likes to mythologize itself, I think does have some truth to it. And I think Dean Smith really did help that because he, I think, sort of demanded that kind of equality. And he wasn't going to sort of stop and say, well, let me consider this. Let me weigh the political and human things going on here with my business, you know, ventures and all that. I think he was very much like, no, this is the way it goes. And everything else takes a backseat to that. So I definitely do think that it worked out the way it did in Chapel Hill because of that context.
Now, one of the goals of the strikers, the original goal was to get decent wages and decent conditions for the food workers. Who, and as your documentary points out, were just treated abysmally. I mean, it's hard to imagine it today. Was the success of that tied as much as anything to the coalition? I mean, could they have succeeded on their own?
Oh, I definitely don't think so. I think it's very easy to suppress a movement, even if it's the entire workforce, which I think it was definitely a majority of the food service workers at UNC at that time. But without the solidarity, particularly from the Black student movement, I definitely don't think it would have worked. And I think there's also an important coalitional context, too, because as the documentary shows, it was very soon that in Greensboro, both at NCANT and UNC Greensboro, the food workers went on strike within a month after they did in Chapel Hill. And at NC State, there was also a non-academic campus worker movement, whether it was food service or janitorial staff, that really did pop off at the same time and provide the same context that I think put fear in the hearts of those in power and really did allow for a small changing of the guard as it is.
When you look at it now, and I know you're not in North Carolina anymore, but you're still closer to that situation than I am or would be. Was this probably the most successful Black student movement for up to that time? I mean, afterwards there were other things happened at Oakland and San Francisco State and places like that. But really, was it the most successful to that point?
I don't want to go out and say that because I don't know the history enough of Black student movements around the country. And of course, if you think about the NCANT students who did the sit-in in 1960, February 1st, 1960 in Greensboro, that changed the world. And their poster, you know, their picture, that image you can see in classrooms and places all around the world. So I don't want to kind of silence those other histories by proclaiming this to be the best. But one thing that the strike did that I think, it wouldn't have worked without the Black student movement, is it raised the wages not only of the cafeteria workers at UNC, but all across the state of North Carolina, because they were state employees at the time. They're not anymore, which I think is an important story to tell in terms of how labor has progressed in the five decades since this strike. But so whether it was dock workers in Wilmington, North Carolina, who worked for the state of North Carolina, or hospital workers in Asheville, anyone who was making the state minimum wage got a pretty hefty raise because of the strike that happened in Chapel Hill. So I think in that sense, it was much more life altering for more people than what a lot of the Black students were able to kind of influence in that same period of time.
We're talking with Joel Schrantz here on Sportslit 101 on Downtown. Before we let you go, Joel, when we look at movements today, and you've done a lot more work on this recently than I have, do you see a future where these kinds of coalitions can work? University of Maine, the graduate students are getting ready to, are trying to organize their union. We don't have a huge African-American population. What we have is to a great extent from the local Sudanese community and Somali community and from our athletic programs, none of whom seem to be aggrieved by the way they're being treated, and I'm pretty close to all of them. But do you think that in academia, where we're seeing shrinking enrollments and we're seeing all kinds of other issues, that these kind of coalitions may be possible again? I mean, I'm asking you for conjecture, I realize, but...
Sure. You know, I certainly hope so. I think we're seeing something really exciting happening sort of across the Delaware River from me here at Rutgers. They have very recently gone on strike and won, but what they've done there is create something in the sense of like one big union. So there's a very large coalition of unions at Rutgers that represent the very low wage, non-academic workers, all the way through the TAs and the RAs, through the graduate students, and all the way up to the part-time and adjunct faculty, and finally the full tenured faculty. So what they've been able to do at Rutgers is really build this big coalition that is taking everyone's interests to heart and also looking out for everyone else. So whether or not that it can happen in other places is yet to be seen, but I love that at least here in Philly, we're seeing Temple graduate workers organize, which has inspired University of the Arts workers, which has inspired University of Pennsylvania workers to all sort of say, hey, we don't have to take this anymore. What's happening to so many different people at the universities these days, and we need to stick together in solidarity.
Yeah, if Penn can't pay him, nobody can, right?
That's right.
Well, Joel, thank you so very much for helping put all this in context. Always like the fact we can call on you, and I'll be seeing you in Fredericton in 6 weeks or so, something like that.
Absolutely. I really look forward to that, and thanks again for having me.
All righty. Thank you very much. That's Joel Schrantz, an independent scholar and a member of Sports Literature Association and an all-around good guy.
That's awesome. Great conversation here on Downtown. Next week, you're on the road, Bruce?
No, next week I'm here, and Okay. Then we have Norm O'Reilly and Rick Burton. Norm will be in studio with us, and Rick will be Zooming with us, and we'll be talking about their book, The Business of the NHL. And then the next two Wednesdays, the 17th and 24th, I'll be on the road, and we'll have Planes, Trains, and Automobile version of Sportslit 101.